You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Market Music with Fairbairn and Russell. Welcome to the Market Musings podcast, where today joining us is the Managing Director of Pantheria Resources, Mark Bolton, and the Chief Operating Officer, Tony Truelove. So we have two guests on the podcast, which is unusual for us, but you're both very welcome. How are you both?
Very well,
thanks very much for having us.
Good. No, it's a pleasure to have you both on. And of course, we have Kenny joining us from Scotland as usual. Kenny, how are you?
Yep, I'm very cold. I was just saying before the podcast started, we've had the first severe frost of the winter, so it's going to take a bit of adjusting. But no, welcome, guys. I imagine where you guys are based, it's a lot warmer than sort of -2, -3 at the moment.
Yeah, you can say that again. It's about 31 here today and 90% humidity.
Well, where is it you're based there, Tony?
It's Brisbane.
Brisbane, all right.
Yes, sunny Queensland.
All right, and what about yourself, Mark?
I'm on the other side of the country. We're about 3,000 kilometres away in Perth, which is, today was about 30-odd and very low humidity. One of the advantages of living in Perth versus Brisbane.
Yeah, definitely. But no, you're both welcome. And as Mark was saying, it's unusual for us to have two guests. Usually it's two versus one, but today it's two versus two. So it's going to be slightly different, but we're looking forward to it. And what we do in this podcast is we're true believers in that you can have the best projects in your company in the world, you know, the best assets, but if you don't have the right people to drive these projects and assets, then it's not going to work. So we like to believe that people make businesses successful. So that's what we try and focus on. So we like to sort of spend 2/3 of the podcast talking about you guys, basically. And it's an opportunity for you to tell us a bit about your background, you know, your working career. You can go, you know, far back as your education or your childhood, and you know, and tell us, obviously, in Tony's case, how you get into geology. And Mark, I've been looking at your bio, and you've got quite an interesting background in corporate finance. So really, it's like a sort of 10-minute platform for each of you, just to tell us a bit about your backstory. You know, what motivates you, what drives you. You know, what the world looks like going forward and how you're going to change it, you know, all the good stuff. So I think we'll probably do it in alphabetical order, Tony. I think we'll put you in the spot first, if that's all right. If you could maybe give us a bit of history. Yep. And you can go back as far as you want, Tony. You can take it right back. It's really okay. Up to you.
No problems. Look, I was born in Sheffield in Yorkshire, as you can tell by my strong Yorkshire accent. But I came to Australia as a tempam pom when I was 8 years old. So I really think of myself much more as an Australian than an Englishman at this stage in my life. One of the earliest memories I have is my father running the general store in a little town called Andamooka in South Australia, which is an opal mining town. And I think that's where my first love of geology started. I used to go and collect nice fossils all around the countryside, and I used to make a little bit of pocket money by going over the old spoil dumps that the professional opal miners had left behind. And we used to, if I got a Beck's bottle full of little chips of opal, that would get me $20. So probably a couple of weeks' work to do that. So, look, I think that's really where my interest in geology started. And from then on, I always used to look at any shiny rocks, and eventually I ended up going to Adelaide University doing a science degree. As part of the science degree, I did the normal science subjects, so maths, physics, chemistry, but I really loved geology, and I loved getting out into the field, getting away from the office or the lab, and getting out there and doing some work. So I think that's how I really came to be a geologist. So my first job out of university, I was immediately transferred from Adelaide to the far north of Queensland, a place called Cairns, which you've probably heard of, sits on the Barrier Reef, a tropical paradise. So it was a bit of a hardship posting for a young geologist, I made do anyway. And I was working on a tin project up in the rainforest north of Cairns, and that was a very interesting way to start my career. Mostly when you're a geologist, you do a lot of geological mapping. And so you have to go knock on the farmer's door and say, look, do you mind if I come on your land and have a look at your rocks? And they normally invite you in for a cup of tea. Up in that part of the world, if you knocked on their door, they'd say, yeah, that's cool, man. Would you like a spliff? So it was a very alternative lifestyle, okay, type of community up there. So look, that was with a big company. That was called, it's basically the Shell, Royal Dutch Shell, but it was their Australian division and their metals division. And that eventually became Billiton, which is most people know now as BHP Billiton. So I had about the first 7 years of my career with probably one of the biggest companies in the world, which is a very good education for a young geologist. And as part of that, I was lucky enough to discover a very, very large gold deposit in the Northern Territory called Mount Todd. And in fact, if you look at the old geological reports for Mount Todd, there were two main pits there, a large one called Batman and a smaller one called Robin. And that was me in my exuberance of youth, giving them names that I thought wouldn't get through the system, but for some reason they did. So that was a great feeling to take this from a piece of moo pasture, if you like, to as it is now, it's probably an 8 to 10 million ounce ore body. Very, very big system, very low grade. And so that was an excellent way to start my career.
And very hard rocks.
And very hard rocks, yes. Yeah, it's
was it a factor of about 18 or something, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was the highest bond work index that the metallurgists had ever seen. We used to call it ping rock, because when you hit it with your geopick, it'd go ping. and send ricochets everywhere. So, but yeah, it was a good way to start. So after that, I changed to work. I was about 7 years with Shell, and then I joined Newmont, who everybody knows is probably the biggest gold company in the world. Mm-hmm. And they, at that time, merged their Australian gold assets with those of BHP and BHP Gold, and became Newcrest Mining. So I was there at that transition stage. And during that stage, I ran all the exploration out of the Kalgoorlie office, which is in the Eastern Goldfields. And Kalgoorlie is the biggest gold mine in Australia and probably one of the biggest gold mines in the world. And I did exploration around there. I then got transferred up to a place called Tuckabianna, where I became a chief mine geologist for the mine there, which was a bit of a change for me because I'd always been in exploration. And it's actually a bit of an eye-opener for an explorationist to see the engineers giving you a hard time because what you said was there wasn't there. Mm. Or, you know, why isn't the grade what you said it was? And it all evens out in the end, but it gives you a real sense that you have to get it right at that exploration stage. So I worked for Newcrest for, again, about seven odd years. And then I joined a company called Delta Gold. And Delta was a fantastic company to work for. It was a small company when I joined and became a mid-cap to large company towards the end. They had fantastic ore bodies, Kanowna Belle, Sunrise Dam, Wallaby, and they were making money when gold was $250 an ounce. Mm-hmm. So I think they were about the lowest cost producer in the world. And because of that, of course, you tend not to survive. So they merged and then got taken over by Placer, and then Placer got taken over by Barrick. So during those takeovers, I left and decided I would go and do my own thing. So after working for three very large companies over a period of just over 20 years, I decided that I'd go working for some juniors and mm-hmm. Try and help them with some of the experience I'd gained. One of the first ones was a small company called Indogold, who, as it happens, the chairman of Indogold lived just around the corner from me in Brisbane. And it worked. Turns out that he was one of my colleagues when we both worked for the Shell company or Billiton. So he said, "Tony, would you like to go to India and have a look at this project that we're interested in?" So I thought, "Oh yeah, India. Never been there. That sounds like a good thing to do." So went over to India. They had a nice little project there that was brought to us by yet another Billiton alumni, an Indian guy called Surendra Chakku, who's still our joint venture partner in that project. And we had it looked like a fairly nice project, but there were problems. People said it was refractory and it was small. Anyway, long story short, when we went over there and did the geological mapping and soil sampling, we realized that it was a real monster, and it was going to be a world-class ore body poking out of the ground, low strip ratio, high grade. So at that stage, after we got it to that stage and alerted everybody, the government of India started playing games with us with the tenure. So while that project is certainly the small amount of work we did, we got it up to almost 2 million ounces in JORC categories. And the Geological Survey of India, after we had to stop drilling, they kept drilling, and they've announced a non-compliant resource of nearly 7 million ounces. So it's a monster. It's a world-class ore deposit. It's probably after Mount Todd or equivalent to Mount Todd, it's the biggest ore body I've ever seen. And it's yep. just sat there, which is a crying shame, especially for India. So I've also worked during that time when we couldn't do any work. I consulted for several other companies. Some of them were offshoots of Indogold, which, as you probably know, is now Panthera. So Indogold changed its name and listed subsequent to that event.
Mm-hmm.
And one of our spin-offs was a project that I generated when I was in a gold conference in South Africa called Indaba Mining. And I was there on behalf of Indogold looking for gold projects in West Africa. And one of the stands there had some guys from Germany called Beek Consulting, who but basically had a few gold projects in Tanzania that they were trying to find an owner for.
Hmm.
But when I visited them, I saw that these guys were based in an area called the Erzgebirge in Germany, which literally means all mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And from my time as working on tin projects in North Queensland, I realised that this was an area that was very rich in tin. So I asked the guys who had all the tin projects there. And at that stage, they said, nobody. Are you interested? So went over there, pegged a 100,000-ton tin deposit that was basically lying fallow at the time. And that got eventually spun out into a company called Anglo-Saxony Mining Limited, which is still owned to a large extent by Panthera. So we still have a lot to do with that company.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of brings you a little bit up to date. So so the more recent things, we decided after not being able to do any work in India, the board said, look, we've all had done some work in Africa. How about we go to West Africa and generate some targets there? So a guy called Ian Cooper, who's still working with us, and myself went over there, and we've generated what I think are some excellent targets. So I won't go into too much detail of those at this stage, but suffice it to say that we're actually working on four of those projects at the moment, either in our own right or through another subsidiary called Midea Holdings. And I think that there's to me they're almost as exciting as when we first went to India. So I'll just say watch this space.
Okay, that's a great little story, little history. It's interesting that you went almost in reverse. You started with like the majors right at the top, and then went down with the juniors. What was it that sort of attracted you, let's say, to the juniors and to move away from the big names?
Okay, yeah, good question. At the time, I was with Delta Gold, who, as I said, merged with a company.
Plaster, wasn't it? Wasn't it Plaster?
It merged with a company and became Orion Gold, a small Aussie company, and then they got taken over by Placer. Got taken over by Barrick. And it was like a little bit frustrating as a geologist at that stage to not be able to go out there and do the work because of all the corporate wranglings that was going on. And I guess there's also a lot of bureaucracy in those big companies, and it was a real breath of fresh air to go to a small company where, you know, you can sit down with the chairman over a beer and say, okay, well, what are we going to do today, guys?
Mm-hmm.
And that's got a real a real attraction.
Yeah, there's obviously it's a lot easier to make more money with the junior explorers as well, because you usually take a piece of the equity along the way, which you don't get the opportunities with the bigger companies.
Absolutely, yes, definitely. You're not working for a salary for a junior. You're working partly for a salary, but more for what may come down the track.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can basically control your own destiny. Yeah, I get why you made that transition. But no, it's a fascinating story. And obviously, I mean, you've listed some of the companies or countries that you've worked in. But I mean, it's Zimbabwe, China, India, Korea, West Africa. You know, I imagine the list is a lot longer than that. But
it is. I skipped over a lot, and I saw my wife for about 3 months, I think, last year, and it gets to the stage where she's happy to see me come home and then glad to see me go.
Yeah, a lot of people say that a successful marriage is one that where you're not present 50% of the time.
Yes, absolutely. So yeah, look, I skipped over a lot, but certainly I've worked in places like the far west of China, near the border with Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan, which is a very interesting place. I've worked in the Brazilian rainforest. Just about most of West Africa, a lot of Central Africa and Southern Africa as well, and obviously Europe. So I've had quite a varied career.
That's fantastic, Tony. Mark, can we sort of give you a chance to tell us a bit about your history as well?
Sure. Tony, did you work on it for Tianshan?
Yes, I did. Yes.
Yes. I forgot. Yes. Yes, indeed. Sorry, I'd forgotten that our careers had intersected, but we'd never actually met on in person.
Oh, okay.
No, that's right.
Well, as I said earlier on, I live in Perth, and really, unless you work in the mining or some sort of resources job, mining or energy, you're probably unemployed. So you don't really have much of a career choice unless you leave. So financial services is not a strong suit in Western Australia, mm-hmm. which is fine. My grandfather worked at Vaal Reefs in South Africa on the mines. But anyone who knows the South African mining industry would know the mine I'm referring to. I was born on in a mining town in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
My father was a shift boss at the Cullinan Diamond, and as most Englishmen would, or English, I shouldn't use the word Englishmen anymore, I suppose English person would know, is the Cullinan Diamond is part of the crown jewels.
Mm-hmm.
So I lived in and around the mining industry till I was a young lad, and then spent a few years on the coast in South Africa. As I like to say, is the best decision I never made was when my parents immigrated to Australia when I was 15.
Okay.
And I did a couple of years of school and university in Australia. I didn't go back to South Africa or Africa for 17 years after that. You move to a new country and you're a teenager, you have new friendship groups, you go to school, and why would you go back you look forward.
Mm.
I was a terrible student. Boy, was I a terrible student.
Okay.
I was very fortunate. After about five different courses, and on my third university, I decided finally that maybe I should stop windsurfing and enjoying the beaches of Western Australia, that I better grow up, and proceeded to get very good results and a very good job. So I was very fortunate to join Ernst & Young at that time. And all my clients were mining clients.
Mm-hmm.
So, Tony, you would remember these days. My very first day on the job was as auditor for Grants Patch, Red Rock. Remember the old Forsyth?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
By the way, all of these names I mentioned were ultimately wrapped up by Placer Dome and ultimately Barrick. I can remember in my first month, Tony, being put on a plane, a little four-seater, to Peak Hill, and trying to land on a dirt runway, dodging kangaroos while waiting for the fog to lift, in the goldfields.
Yes, you have to buzz it once and then come back around to scare the animals off.
Yeah.
Kangaroos away. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep.
So it was amazing. So whilst I worked for Ernst & Young, which obviously is a big four accounting firm, and most people associate it with glass buildings and blue suits, I spent all my time out working for mining companies, big and small. After about 5 years in audit, I was fortunate. I managed to transfer into the corporate finance group, and my very first client, as a pimple-faced wannabe investment banker, inverted commas, was Aquarius Platinum. At that stage, Aquarius had a market cap of 8 million. I haven't looked at the market cap on AIM lately, but I'm sure it's about $1 billion or thereabouts.
Right.
So they were my first client, and they couldn't pay my bills for 6 months. Mm. But anyway, we soldiered on. I was part of their feasibility study team, and I was working on the financial side, and obviously we had the metallurgists and geologists and so forth. And what they had was the Kroondal Platinum Mine, or later mine, but it was a project at that stage. And it became the first new platinum mine in South Africa for 20 years. And arguably the first one outside of the big three, Amplats, Implats, and Northam at the time, and it essentially reinvigorated the entire platinum sector in South Africa. So I worked mostly whilst I worked for Ernst & Young. Most of my time was working with Aquarius, I was part of the team that then went forward and listed Aquarius on the AIM in 1999. Mm-hmm. And I like to say that was the first resources company to list on AIM and really started the boom of resources on AIM. But actually, that's not true. It was the second. Because you go back 5 years before that, there was the first company mining company to list on AIM was a company called Gold Mines of Sardinia. And when I was an audit grad, they were my client. I didn't quite understand what AIM was in those days, just out of school, so to speak, quite naive. After being involved with Aquarius went from, struggling junior to an incredibly successful roller coaster ride that made the careers of many fund managers in London during the initial boom. And as a consequence, enormous number of Australian companies followed the Aquarius model. So I was kept busy for many years helping many Australian companies list on AIM. That was about the first 10 years of my career. And then the CEO at Aquarius and a local stockbroker started an investment company and asked me to join them, which I did. And that I guess, was the second chapter of my career. Essentially, I spent 6 years running around the world looking for projects. Mm-hmm. Assets, companies to invest in and help and incubate. We were effectively an incubate vehicle for early stage unlisted mining projects. That's where Tianshan came from when I found that gold project in Western China. Once we found the project, we needed a vehicle for it, and we backed it into a company at the time, County Diamonds, that then renamed to Tianshan, and that's how we made a living in those days. So I was very lucky. Over those 6 years, we were involved with five new mines that were built. Things change, and we merged. The company did so well. We were approached by Robert Champion at Krepney, who ran another investment vehicle to merge. My job was transferred to London. But the GFC came along, and I decided to step back and come back home. That was in, 2008? I guess that was the second chapter of my career. And the third chapter is has been what I call on the effectively the client side, working for small and large companies to help build build juniors and large caps fund project developments. So I a lot of that both with both as with the investment company and then subsequently almost all of that was Africa. 80%+ of that was Africa. So I was lucky to be involved with new mine developments and companies in, where was it, South Africa, Zambia, Congo, Malawi, Namibia, all the one, Mauritania. Those are just some of the ones I can remember. I guess the most memorable one job at that time was global CFO for First Quantum. And I remember going, for those that don't know who First Quantum is, it's a Canadian, actually it's dual listed on the LSE, but it's predominantly a Canadian company. It's the largest independent copper producer in the world. At the time I was there, it was a market cap of about 20 odd billion US. Yeah, so I guess what does that all mean? I feel like I've had three careers in one, mostly focused on Africa, and you know, my expertise and specialty is building teams, building projects, and making sure they're well funded.
Okay. Yep.
And that's what led me to Panthera.
Right. Well, it sounds like you've got this sort of perfect relationship. Obviously, Tony, you've got the coal face experience. You know, 30+ years, and as you said in your bio, you know, you've been all over, including places like, you know, Brazilian rainforest, etc. And obviously, Mark, you've got this the high level corporate strategy and finance behind you. So it sounds like a perfect match. And that kind of brings us nicely on to the company itself, because we've obviously spent a good, you know, half an hour talking about you guys. So I think it's only fair we move on to the company. And just before we start talking about the company, obviously the company is focused in Africa and India. Could one of you just maybe give us a sort of 2 minute? I mean, obviously, the cultural differences between the continent and obviously in India as well are huge. What's it like to operate in these countries?
I spend a lot of time in India. I've been there probably 20 times, and India is a very interesting place to work. The people are fantastic. Obviously, the food's very good. The countryside's nice. There's a lot of poverty, of course, if you get in. Away from the main populated areas, but yeah, it's quite civilized. A lot of people speak English. It's actually quite a nice place to work. Now, on the flip side, of course, is the bureaucracy there and all the hassles that we've had. And I think, you know, if you take it all together and just think, well, you know, what's it like to work in India? I'd say it's fantastic when you're there on the ground, but just trying to get things done, get decisions made, get anything achieved at a high level is difficult.
I know this answer. I appreciate that. Moving on to the company, obviously a gold-focused company, Africa and India. Would one of you guys be kind enough to give us an overview of the projects? Or you can do it between you. It's entirely up to you guys.
Well, I'll let Tony give a little summary on book here. And I'll give the high-level summary on Africa, because that'll be very high-level. There's so many. So Tony can... We can't delve too deeply. Look, Africa has been a bit of a hidden gem in the Panthera portfolio. There was an attempt sort of 2-3 years ago to make it work, but it didn't have the momentum at the time. It also didn't have Lobola at the time. And a combination of a fresh start, being me reinvigorating that asset portfolio, a fantastic gold price, and a late to the party lead asset in the form of Lobola has basically invigorated an exceptionally interesting West African portfolio. Even when I took the job with Panthera, I had not appreciated in any shape or form how good the West African assets were. I was focused entirely on India.
Yeah.
And what I believed I could achieve there, having just, you know, dealt with some very prickly issues in India quite successfully, and I thought, I think I can solve this one as well. But coming back to Africa, what we have is now after the deal with Moi Dao is six assets, ranging from very advanced, almost pre-project development Lobola to the other extreme in Nigeria, which is early stage strategic land holdings in known artisanal areas. Mm-hmm. And in the middle, what we have is Kalaka, Basala, and Bido, which are known discoveries with ore grade intersections or artisanal mining multiple fields of artisanals, mining ore grade projects. So it's a very broad portfolio, which gives us diversification, both by project, also by target. Some of these projects have multiple targets, like Bido, we've got five. But they're also multiple jurisdictions. So we're dealing in Burkina, Nigeria, and Mali. We have obviously the diversification of risk, where we've got Lobola with 65,000 meters of drilling already completed, and the guys are working on putting out a maiden JORC resource in the new year. Mm-hmm. To Nigeria, where, you know, we'll be drilling exploration holes this month. So it's a full suite of assets, and very unusually within in a company that has a market cap of less than $10 million to have that depth of and breadth of assets. Mm. So I'd be very happy if Panthera didn't have India. I mean, obviously I want it, don't get me wrong. It's a fabulous asset. But Panthera exists with or without India.
Okay.
Yeah.
And are your projects, are they like children? Do you love them all equally, or do you sort of perhaps favor one over the other?
No, there's definitely favorites. Come on. We don't admit it, but you definitely have we're in the mining industry, particularly the junior. If you end up in the junior industry, you have to have gold fever. It's unavoidable. you have to be getting messages at 11, 12 at night going like, is the drill rig turning? What's the assay result? We're more harped than the chap rooms. Otherwise, why do we do this?
I must admit, with that Lobola asset, I mean, the 65,000 meters of drilling caught my eye. I mean, that's a fantastic database of information that you've got there already. I assume that was done by previous companies, or have you done some of that yourself?
That's all done by previous companies. So it's a bit, our news flow on Lobola at the moment is very quiet. That will change probably early in the new year. We adopt a very scientific approach to everything we do from a technical point of view. And Tony's background at a big company means that's his his mantra, and that's mine as well. And the reason being is everything we do, you have to be able to say, no regrets. Should I and did I have the information before I made the decision to spend money? That's the philosophy we adopt. So what does that mean practically for Lobola? It means making sure we fully comprehend all the data we have before we spend one dime adding value. That process of evaluating the data is very advanced now. Part of the when I joined Panthera, the market cap was about $5 million. I'm a big fan of minimizing dilution. The largest cost in the development of any mining project is actually dilution. It's not the construction cost, the exploration cost, the drill cost. It's dilution. What we realized is, yes, we got some great projects, but if we spend any money on them, we're actually just developing the projects for the new shareholders. That doesn't make money for the existing shareholders.
Yep, perfect. Just before we jump on to India, Tony, to me there seems a wee dark horse in the project portfolio as well with the asset in Germany, because obviously you alluded that it was about to potentially list, so that's obviously going to boost the balance sheet potentially somewhere along the line.
Yes, look, it's a very interesting project. It's just had a pre-feasibility study completed on a TIM project that's only located about 120 kilometres from Dresden. So it's sort of half a day's drive to Prague or Berlin or Paris. It's a beautiful part of the world. It was a project where nearly all the work had been done for us. It was all done in the East Germany Soviet era, and they did meticulous work there. So it's one of the largest undeveloped TIM projects around, and it's had some. It was always thought to be uneconomic due to metallurgical issues, but we solved all those. We partnered with a consortium of local universities, and we now realise that it's actually two ore bodies or two mineralization events superimposed, and the majority of the tin came in with the second, and that's easy to get out. So that was a real turnaround. And yes, we're getting a lot of interest from European and in particular German and in particular local Saxon investors. A lot of political interest as well, and that's really a big help.
Oh, excellent, good stuff. Mm. All right, and now obviously, Tony, while we've got your attention, you can give us the inside track in India.
Yeah, sure. Look, the project in India is called Bukia, and it is in the southern part of Rajasthan. Rajasthan's a great state. It's one of the more well developed states. It's got a long history of mining. One of the largest zinc mines in the world is there, called Rampura Agucha. So they understand mining. It's been mined on by modern techniques by a modern company. That's Vedanta Mine. So the geology of this thing is quite unusual, and there's a lot of interest in the areas around Telfer at the moment in the north of Western Australia, and a lot of new discoveries being made by the likes of Newcrest and Rio Tinto. I think the geology we're looking at is quite similar there. It's a similar age rocks, so they're lower Proterozoic in age. It's an unusual style of deposit. It's definitely structurally related, and we think it's related to an underlying granite and something along the lines of an iron oxide copper gold deposit. Having said that, it's such a big alteration system, it's very difficult to see what the original rocks were. They've all been altered to quartzites, dolomites, calc silicates. So the whole thing has just been metamorphosed and metasomatized beyond recognition. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing is the there is very little in the way of quartz or silica alteration there, which is, again, reminiscent of Telfer. The mineralization occurs in several zones, and in fact, we think these were mined back as long ago as 500 BC, and that's come from dating some timbers in some of the old zinc mines further to the north. Mm-hmm. But there's all the old in that time, the miners were basically getting what they could get with stone tools. So anything harder than the stone tools they were using, they couldn't get. So they didn't dig down anywhere beneath the weathering profile. And they were using mortars and pestles and panning these things. So all they were getting was the massive sulfide layers that had weathered to this soft, rusty, gossany material. Mm-hmm. And when we came in and did the soil sampling, we realized that in between these zones was almost as high a soil anomaly as within them. And we know that it's outcropping, so it's unlikely to be due to transported material. That anomaly is about 3 or 4 kilometers long and a couple of kilometers wide. And I did a little exercise of superimposing that the soil anomaly onto the Cadia pit and the Telfer pit, and they're both plus 10 million ounce deposits. And those the soil anomaly was bigger than those pits. So look, it's a huge system. As I said, the Geological Survey of India have drilled it, and they've quoted a resource of about over 100 million tonnes at 1.5 grams, and mm-hmm. also about 0.2 copper. And interestingly enough, also a significant amount of cobalt in there as well. So that works out to about nearly 7 million ounces. And even though they had the soil sampling available to them, they focused basically on the old workings. So still a lot of potential in between those workings. So my gut feel as a geologist is that this is going to be much bigger than a 10 million ounce deposit, and you don't find too many of those in your working career.
No.
Not nowadays, no. And obviously, this all hinges on a prospecting license. This is the next stage.
Yes, correct. Yes. So we did as much work as we could under what's called a reconnaissance permit, which is a bit like an exploration license. And then we had to convert that to a prospecting license. And that's when we basically have been arguing the toss in the courts ever since that time.
As Tony said early on the call, it's a shame it hasn't been developed yet, and that's our goal is to develop it, and when we do, it'll be in everyone's best interest, being the local community, the government, and our shareholders.
Yeah, so it's company transformational, as Tony said. You know, there's mm-hmm. potential for 10 million ounces there. You know, it'll add a zero at least onto your market cap. You know, if it comes off, you know.
Oh, it'll add a lot more than 1-0, I can assure you.
Yeah, definitely.
India as well. I don't think we've had spoken to a company that's had a project in India, have we, Kenny, before? It's a first.
It's a first. It's a first. Mm. But Mark, do you want to put the guys in the spot with our usual challenge and see which one of them's up for it?
Yeah. So, what we often do is ask. The guests, the directors that come on to the opportunity to do a 60-second pitch, almost like an elevator pitch. So obviously you have 60 seconds to, and it might be quite difficult with everything that's going on in Pantheria, but 60 seconds to kind of pitch the company to investors as to why it's worth considering as an investment. So there's obviously two of you. We could do 2 60 seconds and see who gets close to the time, or one of you can go for it. It depends how you both feel.
I'll tell you what, to the listeners out there, will know the winner, because what we'll agree to do is you pick the best one, and that's the one that survives the cut, and therefore the listeners will get to hear the better of the two. How's that sound?
That sounds fine to me. Yeah, okay. Do you want to have a go first then, Mark?
Sure. I guess the key value proposition for Panthera is the sheer diversity of opportunity set, particularly focused on Africa, where we've got six very interesting gold projects, any of which can be a company maker. That's going to drive a lot of news flow and activity over the next 12 months. Our business plan has us working all those properties between now and Christmas next year. And then on the side, in parallel, we're working to resolve the long-standing license dispute in India regarding the Tier 1 project, which is Bukia. Whilst we can't guarantee that we can fix Bukia, we're certainly very optimistic that that we can deliver on that outcome. And we only ask shareholders to judge us by our performance. In other words, not our promises, but what we deliver over that 12-month window, because I think the projects will sustain a strong return for shareholders based on the assets we have.
Okay, good. That was just about 67 seconds, I think, around there. So, yeah, that's excellent. Well done. So Tony, over to you if you want to have a go at that as well.
Okay, I'll give it a go. I hope you can beat Mark.
No pressure, mate, Tony.
No pressure.
I hope you win, Tony.
Okay. Well, look, my pitch would be that Panthera is a very undervalued company. It's got some fantastic projects in West Africa, and I think it's undervalued on those alone. We've got advanced stage targets as per Lebola, which could become a development project as early as sometime next year. We've got some excellent earlier stage projects, one of which has just had a gold rush of about several hundred miners in an area that was never thought of as an artisanal area before. So, and also we are only spending on two of those projects in our own right, so we're not going to be diluting too much. And then we've got the wild card of Bukia in India, which is a real company maker. And by any stretch of the imagination, and if we can sort out the legal issues there, that will add one or two zeros at least onto our share price. So it's almost like having a lottery ticket in the background.
Yeah, okay. Do you know what? I'm finding this podcast very spooky because you two seem to have a lot in common. You're both immigrants to Australia. You've crossed paths in your various careers. And I didn't have an exact time on that, but it looks about the same, about 67, 68 seconds. So I think you're a match made in heaven, you two.
I'm voting for him. Not that we can see you guys voting, but I vote for Tony's pitch.
I think they both have merit. I think we'll leave both in, and then it gives you two bites of the cherry. So, but there we go. But no, it's been absolutely brilliant having you on, guys. And believe it or not, that's almost probably an hour.
It's an hour.
It's came and gone already. So I think before my meter runs out, I think we'll just thank you for coming on. It was a great insight into both your careers. And I mean, I was aware of the Panthera Resources, but I never really looked deeply into it. So now I'm going to go and have a look. So you've perked up my interest right away. So I appreciate the time. And obviously, it's quite late in Australia. I think it's maybe 9 hours difference for you, Tony, between us, I think.
It's definitely GNT.
It's about 9 o'clock here. So
sorry, Tony.
Yeah.
It's definitely GNT time.
Yeah.
That'll be the next thing, or a good single malt, I think.
Well, you deserve it. Thank you both very much for your time. It's been great getting an insight into your history and of course the company. I've really, really enjoyed it.
Thanks, guys.
Oh, thank you, Mark. Thank you very much, Kenny.
It was great. Yes. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks, then.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you for listening to another podcast from Market Musings with Fairbairn and Russell. Tune in next time.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.